religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour. Tonight, January the 20th on the West Coast, or if you are living on the East Coast or in the Central Time Zones, it's already the early morning hours of January the 21st. We have a great, great guest. I've admired this gentleman's work for a number of years. His specialty is underground bases and tunnels. And with that, we're bringing on board Evident Footprints for the first time, but I can assure you, likely not the last time, Dr. Richard Sauder. Dr. Sauder, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Don. I'm glad to be here.
When I first got into underground bases and tunnels, I was introduced to quite a large variety of phenomena that were going on around the world. And eventually, some years later, I came across a few public speeches that Phil Schneider was giving. And it's incredible as much of the information was, it seemed to have a ring of truth to it. And as time went on, I was able to myself connect the dots in my own mind and my own understanding of what might be going on underground. And, of course, there's a lot of disinformation out there. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of speculation as to why and what and who and how and when all this began occurring, and you're considered the world's expert on this topic, so I think it would help our listening audience to understand how you got started in the work that you do, and sort of set us straight with all the myths that are out there.
Well, thank you, Don, for those, you know, that praise. I appreciate it. I have to qualify your remarks a little bit by saying that I know the information I have gleaned from the outside. I am not a so-called insider. I have never worked for a United States government agency, civilian or military. I haven't worked in industry for the Fortune 500 companies or any of the companies involved in making secret or clandestine facilities. So what I know, I have learned from the outside peering in, nor have I been privy to any classified information or information from the black world or special access programs. So in that sense, I am not the world expert, because the world experts on this material are those who work on the inside in these highly compartmentalized and secretive and massively funded high-tech programs that my research indicates have been going on at least since the 1940s and perhaps much earlier than that. Now, I got into this, you could say I was initiated at a very, very early age when I was a toddler, when I had an encounter with a being that I would think was some sort of demigod or demigoddess, if you will, that I named the age of the three, the Bone Lady. She showed up on my roof and made as much of as big an impression on me as anyone or anything in my entire life, and to this day I can't forget her, and that was a half a century ago. But what the Bone Lady did was initiate me into the broader reality that the world, or what we can perceive, phenomena, whether they're mental, spiritual, physical, emotional, are not limited to the 3D world of time, space, and motion that we have drilled into our heads by our culture and our school system. So from a very young age, I understood that it all is so very much vaster than we are led to believe by mainstream society and the so-called authority figures in it. From that age to the present day, the unusual, mind-bending, paranormal, and you might even see otherworldly experiences in some cases continue. They've never ended. My life has just been unusual in that regard, and I'm not sure if it's that I'm different in that respect or that I just talk much more openly about what I have seen and learned and experienced than most other people. I think a lot of people have tremendous fear and carry a very heavy fear load, and they bottle up inside what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they've seen, what they've observed, what they understand, and I think we pay a price for that. So at a very, very early age, I came to understand there is a large game afoot, and it involves human beings and more than human beings, and that the world is a mysterious, even a magical place. Now, coming down much later through the decades to my adult life, in 1992, I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, pursuing a doctorate in political science, which I subsequently did obtain. But over the holidays in 1992, between Christmas and New Year's Day, I was sound asleep one night when I was suddenly awakened out of a deep sleep, maybe 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, in the wee hours of the morning. I was very awake, suddenly very alert mentally, but very relaxed physically, and I was laying there in the dark with a large question mark figuratively hovering over my head in the dark, when within 2 or 3 seconds, I heard a very distinct voice speak clearly and matter-of-factly, a disembodied voice, in my head, in my inner ear. And the voice said, the underground bases are real. Now, that meant a great deal to me because just about a month and a half earlier, I had published an article in UFO Magazine, which is published out of Los Angeles, California, by Don and Vicki Ecker. And in that article that appeared the first part of November 1992, I had dealt with this very topic of underground bases. When I moved out to the Southwest in the late 1980s, for the first time in my life to any appreciable degree, I had heard people talking about purported secret underground bases and alleged tube shuttle trains that connected these bases at high speed and in great secrecy, where ostensibly secretive elements of the military-industrial espionage complex and alleged little gray aliens were working together, cheek by jowl, conducting very bizarre genetic engineering and cloning experiments and programs, among other things. Now, I thought all of that was very strange. I didn't dismiss the stories. I thought, on the one hand, maybe they're false and it's just science fiction and rumor mongering. Or on the other hand, maybe there's some truth to these stories. Maybe there's a kernel of a truth in these rumors that I've been hearing. So I decided to check into it, did a little research, and I found out, indeed, a number of agencies of the United States government, both military and non-military, had underground facilities all over the country. Agencies such as FEMA, the Department of Energy, the Federal Reserve System, NORAD, the United States Army, the CIA, etc. And so I documented some of these in the article that appeared in UFO Magazine, and I said in the article that while I couldn't say if there are little gray aliens underground in secret bases in the United States, that there definitely are underground bases, and a fair number of them, and some of them are large and elaborate. So I published that in that article, and I thought, well, you know, I've been there and done that, end of story, period. Well, not so, you see. Sometimes you think you're done with something, and the reality is you have only just begun.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, I had just barely scratched the surface, if you'll pardon the pun. And I was awakened in the middle of night then, see, within that context, by this voice speaking, not in my ear, but it was in my inner ear. And I immediately knew what he was talking about. It was the voice of a man, of an adult male. It sounded like a Caucasian, speaking normal, educated, late 20th century North American English. In other words, a native speaker of North American English.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very matter-of-fact. He said, the underground bases are real. Immediately I understood I wasn't hearing the voice of God or an angel or Jesus or an alien or that I was crazy or anything like that. I knew that none of that was the case. I knew that I was hearing the voice of a real flesh and blood man. I also intuited immediately that he was using some kind of technological means to beam his voice into my inner ear. I understood all of that within the first half a second. And he went on to say that, indeed, there are large and elaborate, sophisticated underground installations, and that there are involved in complex projects and programs being carried out down there. And as he spoke, I got the impression of high technology, a lot of people going on underground, a lot of activities, and strange and exotic and unusual and advanced and sophisticated cutting-edge technology and different corporations and agencies. And it was clear to me from what he was describing to me that there was had to be a massive level of funding and personnel involved in this. So he went on in that vein, and more or less in generalities, for 2 or 3 minutes, and then he stopped speaking as abruptly as he had begun. And I was left laying there in the dark thinking, oh, my, isn't this something? You know, this is mind-blowing,
mm-hmm.
actually. So after a little while, I decided, well, you know, I can't resolve this lying here in the middle of the night. So I went back to sleep. Of course, when I awoke the next morning, I remembered very clearly what had happened during the night, and I resolved then and there, you know what, I'm going to look more deeply into this, if you'll pardon yet a second pun. So I went and immediately began doing a literature search, because I know I have 4 university degrees, and I've done so much research, and I know how bureaucracy works. I don't care if it's even a secret bureaucracy. Any bureaucracy in this day and age generates reams of paper for paper clips, if nothing else. Reams mm-hmm. of paper to order paper. Invoices, memos, you know, project reports, draft notes from meetings, orders for machinery, on and on. Letters to people thanking them for things. I mean, bureaucrats, administrators, and bureaucracies in general just generate paper. And I knew that even if these were secret projects, that some of that paper had to fall through the cracks, because there had to be so many millions of pages of documents floating around out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and started looking. You know what, Don? I found a lot of documentation, because, in fact, my intuition was true. A lot of paper has fallen through the cracks, and enough of it, even of the unclassified variety, has fallen through the cracks that I now know, yes, indeed, there are a lot of underground facilities. They can certainly be very deep, very large, very sophisticated. There's a lot of high technology down there. There certainly are many people working down there in great secrecy, and it's been going on my entire life, your entire life, and perhaps long before that. Now,
yeah, if I can interrupt just for a second, Richard,
yes, sir.
And ask you 2 questions. Number
yes.
one, this voice, well, let's take the latter comment first. The voice that you heard, were you able to discern if that was a telepathic voice?
Here's what I've been able to find out.
Okay.
There is some, once you dig into the literature, and I was aided by this, I have to say, by 2 Austrian researchers, Helmut and, Marion Lammer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they did some excellent work. Most of their research is published in the German language. Perhaps their best-known work is entitled Verdeckte Operationen. And the best English translation of that would be something like hidden projects, hidden operations, concealed
yeah.
operations. In other words, what we would know as special access programs, compartmentalized programs, black ops would be a general English translation of what they mean by that German
mm-hmm.
expression. But they were at one time 2 of the best researchers in the world. The problem is that most of their best work is published in English. I did write the foreword to one of their works that was published in English in abbreviated form entitled MyLabs, MLABS. meaning military abductions.
Yeah.
But after doing research, there is something called electronic telepathy or artificial telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns
That's
out that, in fact, yes, and there are patents for this in the open literature. I think the work that's been done in the black world by the military and the espionage agencies especially is very advanced. The mind control, the physical electronic mind control technology available today in the black world is very advanced. But even on the open literature, in 1989, the United States Patent Office granted a patent number 4858612 entitled Hearing Device, which is euphemistic. They should have really entitled it Brain Transmitter. Let me just read you a few sentences from the abstract.
Okay.
It says, a method and apparatus for simulation of hearing in mammals. That covers a lot of territory, I think. You know, Homo sapiens are mammals, certainly. In mammals, by introduction of a plurality of microwaves into the region of the auditory cortex, which is what I experienced. A microphone is used to transform sound signals into electrical signals, which are in turn analyzed and processed to provide controls for generating a plurality of microwave signals at different frequencies. The multi-frequency microwaves are then applied to the brain in the region of the auditory cortex. By this method, sounds are perceived by the mammal, which are representative of the original sound received by the microphone. And they have a little schematic diagram of this, and they have a little sketch of the mammal's head in profile, and the mammal in question is a human, and they have a little sketch of a human head there with the microphone right up to the ear. So, the microphone, the transmitter, or the antenna, right up to the ear. So, that's what was used on me in a nutshell. I have no doubt whatsoever about it. What I believe happened is that someone on the inside of one of these programs read my article in UFO Magazine and probably got access to a couple of minutes of transmitter time and either beamed it into my, probably beamed it into my head from an orbiting satellite. I have a known address. We all do. It can be discovered by anyone with access to any public database, really, in a matter of minutes. And you can usually presume at 2 o'clock in the morning most people are asleep in their bed. So if you target their house, you got them.
Yeah. Now, in respect to the bone lady that you referred to at the top of the show, did she identify where she was from, and were you able
to
communicate this to your family members anyone like that?
Well, you have to understand, Don, I was 3 years old, and at the age of three, your understanding of the world or even of your family structure is very vague and ambiguous. You know you have a mommy and a daddy and maybe a sibling or two, and beyond that, the world is just a vast, inscrutable blur when you're 3 years old. And as well, when you're three, you don't have a very large vocabulary. You're verbal, but barely.
Yeah.
And so I have to tell you that were it all to happen to me today, I could probably converse much more fluently about the experience. Most of the communication between us was nonverbal. In fact, I believe it all was. I think it was also at a genetic level. My sense of the bone lady then and now is, as I indicated to you, I think she's a kind of demigoddess being. I don't know if she would be, if I saw her today, whether I might perceive her as one of the mantis type of creatures, or maybe she really was a manifestation of Kali from the Hindu pantheon. I couldn't tell you precisely. I don't know. I have seen her in dreams occasionally over the years, and don't have any more insight into her. I will tell you, whoever she is a distinct personality and a powerful one, very well integrated, and that's about all I can say there. Now moving on to the underground bases coming down to the 20th and 21st century. As I began to do my paper search, I found a lot of documents. I went to the federal technical documents and went right into the guts of a major federal documents collection, and there are 100 or so of these around the country. And I went to one of the good ones, and I spent a lot of time just digging through piles and reams of documents until I got a clearer picture of what was going on. When I first started, I started way back in the 40s in the World War II era. And I noticed that during the World War II era that the Third Reich had made a lot of facilities underground. And in fact, when the Allies went into Nazi-controlled territories after World War II, they found hundreds of underground installations. There may have even been more than that, but hundreds have been documented in the open literature. And some of them were very large and elaborate. I mean, impressively so, even by today's standards. And after, you have to understand that during World War II, whether or not this was the genesis of the modern round of secret underground base construction or not, I can't say. But during World War II, there, or during the Third Reich, actually, there was an organization or an agency called Organisation Todt. It was founded by a man named Fritz Todt, who was the father of the German Autobahn system, which is world-renowned for the level of sophisticated level of civil engineering. This was the baby of Fritz Todt. He was an engineering genius. During the Third Reich, he was tapped by Adolf Hitler to create and administer an agency that would be roughly analogous to the Army Corps of Engineers in the contemporary American military system. With this difference, the Army Corps of Engineers in our system is really part of the organized military structure and falls in the Pentagon command structure. Under the Third Reich, while Organisation Todt worked very closely with, especially with the Wehrmacht and with the SS, to a degree also with the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine, it also worked in the civilian sector. That is to say that people, a man like Fritz Todt was never a uniformed officer in any of the military branches or in the SS or Gestapo or anything like that. Nevertheless, this organization worked very closely, I mean hand in glove, with the German military. Now, in 1942, Fritz Todt was killed, and one of his right-hand men named Xaver Dorsch, D-O-R-S-C-H, took over most of his administrative duties, and the actual directorship, if you will, of the organization passed to Albert Speer, and then next in command was Hitler. Well, about a year and a half before the end of the war, when the tide of battle had turned against the Third Reich, Hitler took command from Speer and gave it directly to Xaver Dorsch and tasked him with making a series of very deep, very large, very elaborate industrial production facilities for aircraft and other purposes. And so the Nazis really had a crash program in making these big, huge, elaborate underground facilities. Some of what they've done has been revealed on the public record. I'm persuaded that a lot of what was found by the Russians, the French, the English, and also by the Americans when they went in, especially into Germany proper after World War II and in the closing months of World War II, remains classified and unknown to this day. I don't have any doubt about that. But what I do know, because I got some declassified Project Paperclip memos out of the archives in NASA's history archives in Washington, D.C., what I do know is that following the war, Xaver Dorsch was asked for by name by Project Paperclip. They wanted to bring him to the United States. I don't know if they ever did. However, I do know that he spent some time under the control of the United States Army in prisoner of war camps after World War II, and they debriefed him, in fact. I have two of the debriefing documents from him. One he wrote and was published, or at least was transcribed, on September 1st, 1946, in Steinlager Allendorf.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of his, the organization Tote in English, in France and in Germany. And then there's another one also called just Organisation Tote, the Dorsch Project, which was also given over by him and also to the army. He was taken prisoner actually on the 7th of May in 1945 at Tegernsee in Bavaria. So he was asked for by name to come to the United States to work on something that the Project Paperclip memo called the Underground Plant Program for the United States Army or military. And that was in 1947, the first part of 1947. I believe it's highly probable, since the Army had him in their custody, according to hard documentation, in 45 and 46, that he probably did come to the United States. He did surface again in Germany in 1952. I can find another public record of him, and he established a very well-known civil engineering firm that exists to this day. Xaver Dorsch is now deceased, but the civil engineering firm he established back in the 1950s still exists. It's very well-known and respected in Germany to this day. So he didn't just disappear. After the war, he went into American military custody for a period of time, and then after several years, he resurfaced in Germany. My guess is in that several-year period in between, he was working for the American military, and I know from my documentation that it's during that period precisely that the military did begin a program, which they have not ceased to the present day, of constructing large, deeply buried, sophisticated, secret and or very highly secure and controlled underground facilities. Some
yes,
of them are known.
I've got a couple of questions I want to ask you.
Yes, sir.
Did you come across the story, which I deduce is nothing but the usual spin when they turn these ex-SS officers or people that have a close...
Now, he wasn't SS. I don't believe he was ever a military officer.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying in general, SS officers that they want to sneak into, like the U.S. through Operation Paperclip, or,
yes,
or people who worked in engineering or construction,
yes,
those types of things.
Yes.
They turn them into spooks. In other words, they create the rumor that they died, and they move on, and then they're free to work underground, no pun intended. Now, supposedly, Tote died on February 8th of 1942 from an exploding aircraft, number one.
Yeah,
and I was wondering if you came across that. And then I was also wondering...
He was killed in an airplane accident in 42. That's well known.
Okay. But do you believe that that's a true story?
Yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. Because the man... and his work were so crucial to the Third Reich, there would be no reason for him to disappear and drop from cover. And in fact, he did disappear, and I don't doubt that he was killed during the war. Not in combat. He was in transit. I don't know exactly where, but it was somewhere within the territory of the Third Reich. He died in an airplane crash. I do believe that. I have no question about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now another question I have, and this is from first-hand knowledge. Are you aware, through your research, did you come across anything about Mannheim and an underground base under Mannheim? Mannheim is about the size of New York.
I spent some time in Mannheim. Personally, I have. And I resided there for a brief time. So I know the town a little bit. It wouldn't surprise me. Let me make one thing clear. Technically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and even decades ago, I would say even already starting in the 40s and 50s, but certainly by the time you get to the 1960s, and it's certainly true in spades today, that it's possible to make an underground facility virtually anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Under the middle of the ocean, under a swamp, under a desert, under a mountain, under a small town, under a forest, under a glacier, under a large city. The technology, it's not magical. This is just nuts and bolts, mining, engineering, technology, and civil engineering. It's possible to make these things almost anywhere. So there could easily have been a facility made under Mannheim in World War II. There could be one there today. The whole place could be an anthill underground. This whole planet could be an anthill underground.
Yeah. When I was there, I met a couple of officers from the American Army who told me that they had actually been underneath the city. There was a particular entrance from a caserne, which is the German term for the barracks, at the main, there are several barracks actually and bases in Mannheim.
Yeah.
And that this base literally expanded the whole city. So we're talking about something the size of New York City.
It could be done. I don't have any proof one way or the other, but I could believe that. And listen, the Americans have been in Germany now for over 60 years. And so whatever the Third Reich did, a lot of that is still there. Some of it has just been walled off and or filled in. But I don't have any doubt that the Americans and Russians took over some of those facilities for their own use and may have expanded them, and perhaps even greatly so. If that were the case, it wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. I can tell you that whatever underground activities the Third Reich may have been involved in, I have to believe have been greatly exceeded by this time in the post-World War II era activities, not only of the Americans, but of others, and not just of military agencies under the control or command of the Pentagon, but of non-government agencies and also of other organizations and agencies operating outside of formal governmental or military administrative or bureaucratic structures. Because so many of the large corporations that build these facilities have a multinational reach, and they have extremely powerful technology. They have funding by the tens of billions or even hundreds of billions in some cases. So they don't even need to go to governments or military agencies to do this. You can also have rogue, what the late Kent Stedman of cyberspaceorbit.com called the Captain Nemo hypothesis. If you have a really wealthy individual, and there are hundreds of billionaires on this planet, any one of them, if he or she really got it in their head to make a large, comfortable, sophisticated underground facility, could go out and buy the engineers and the machinery to make such a facility or multiple facilities. Mm-hmm. And I presume that in some cases that is being done. Now I also want to say that there's a related question here, and that has to do with the funding of all of this.
Yes.
How does it happen? Well, it turns out that if you look into it a little bit, you don't run very far before you find out that there's something called a black budget. And in the United States alone, this runs to trillions of dollars. Now, there's been some attention paid to this and the alternative press, and even much less attention paid to it in the mainstream news media. But there's hard documentation for trillions of dollars that are basically unaccounted for in the federal budget of the United States in recent years. Mm-hmm. Vast sums of money have just somehow gone by the side without being accounted for. Now, the most egregious violator happens to be the Pentagon. But other agencies such as HUD, Housing and Urban Development, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, NASA, the IRS, and so forth also have come up in recent years with billions of dollars of missing funding that they cannot account for. At this point, it's clear that the United States government, to a great extent, is the largest money laundering operation on planet Earth. And I mean the money laundering and the skullduggery is taking place on a vast, mind-numbing scale.
Yeah, now, there's no one in my listening audience that will disagree with you based on some of the shows I've done. So,
well, and some of the best research on this, is there have been a number of people that have looked into this. I want to mention Catherine Austin Fitt's name. I don't. Mm-hmm. If you haven't ever interviewed her, I would recommend her for your show. And if you like, I can put you in touch with her.
Yeah, that would be very nice, yeah. I'm familiar with her work, but I've never had her on. That's true.
She's a wonderful lady. I know her personally. And not only is she a wonderful, gracious woman, she's really intelligent. She knows what she's talking about. She spent her life working in high finance on Wall Street at the highest levels of government, and she knows the whole thing inside and out, and she is an ethical woman. But she has documented, you know, trillions of dollars of missing money. And one of my conversations with Catherine, I don't think she would mind me revealing that I said, you know, we were mulling over the possibilities, and I asked her, Catherine, what can you do with that kind of money? And she said, Richard, anything. Anything you can imagine you can do with that kind of money. So she can elaborate on that if you ever have her on the show. But the interesting thing that I discovered is that I was going through a book. There's a guy named Gulley who was actually working. His name is Bill Gulley, who actually worked in something called the military office in the White House for years, mm-hmm. for decades. At least since the time of Eisenhower, and I think starting in Truman's day even, there's a little-known but extremely powerful office in the executive office of the president called the military office. It interfaces with the Pentagon and the executive office of the president. The executive office of the president is the bureaucracy which we refer in popular discourse and shorthand. We refer to it as the White House. Now, Bill Gulley started working there in the Lyndon Johnson administration in the 1960s. It was carried over through Nixon, Ford, and into the first part of the Carter administration. So he was there a long time. He saw a lot of things, and he ended up writing a book. And from our standpoint, his book is entitled Breaking Cover. From the standpoint of our discussion, he lays out in black and white how this very secretive funding process works. And it's unconstitutional. It's illegal. But he makes clear, he says in the book, he says, in the White House, you never worry about the law. I never worried about breaking the law. This never entered my mind, and I doubt it ever entered the minds of people who asked me to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe for a little bit after Nixon resigned, but it evaporated almost immediately. In other words, he's saying, law, there ain't no stinking law when you're in the White House. You do what you want to, because laws are for other people, not if you're working in the White House. And anyone who knows how the world of politics really works knows that's true. Presidents and their minions and the people to whom they give orders, they don't worry about the law. So he says that they set up, starting all the way back in the 1950s, a series of secret underground facilities all over the country. At that time, 75 of them. My research strongly suggests that there are many more today. And mind you, this was just for the executive office of the president. These were just secret presidential facilities, which were deep, highly secure, and extremely classified. So he goes on to describe that he was in charge of helping to set these things up and operate them. That was part of what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But they set up a secret fund to take care of all of this. And he says, to help ensure secrecy, the money, which at the end of the line was in the sole control of the military office at the White House, was channeled through a circuitous route the cleverest spy or accountant would have trouble following. This was back in the 1950s. We're going back a half a century now. After the money was authorized in the federal budget, the Appropriations Committee allocated it to the Department of Defense as a classified item in the Army Construction Program. The Army, however, was not authorized to spend it. They didn't even know what it was for. So the Army got some money for a classified program, and no one in the Army knew anything about it. He continues, authorization to spend the money, although it was allocated to the Army, was given to the Navy. It's a shell game. Specifically, the Chesapeake Division Navy engineers, who themselves didn't know what the fund was for either. Not even the admiral in charge of the division knew. You following this, Don?
Yes, I am. I've got some questions popping up in my head, but go ahead.
Well, let me finish. There was only one guy in the Chesapeake Division, a commander, who was assigned to them, but responsible to the White House military office, who was aware of the actual purpose, amount, and more important, the actual destination of money from the secret fund. That is how the process worked half a century ago. Now, I got to believe it's even more involved than that today. But that in itself is pretty eye-popping.
Yeah. I've been following this topic for a number of years, and we've talked about it from time to time on Evident Footprints.
Yes.
And the listening audience is aware, and I know that there are other folks out there really looking into it, especially in light of this bailout. But if we went back to September 10th, 2001, what do you think the significance of Donald Rumsfeld revealing to the Congress that $2.3 trillion was lost was? In other words, why do that the day before 9/11?
Well, part of it is to deep six it in the news cycle because he knew what was about to happen. But in actual fact, that story was out earlier. He had spilled the beans to a Congressional Appropriations Committee before that, 2 or 3 months earlier, and that had been out there as public knowledge, not much discussed, by the way. Mm-hmm. And actually, he did make those remarks briefly on September the 10th in a press conference, I believe. It wasn't new news. It was understated news, and you rightly observe that even though it wasn't new news, it still was rather dramatic, at least by my calculus, and it was certainly buried in the news cycle the next day and really hasn't surfaced to any meaningful extent since. Your observation is very apt. I want to say that when you're talking about these rumors of a very high-speed tube shuttle system that is alleged to underlay not only the United States but some other regions of the world. You will even read some people's rumors here and there on the internet or see them in pulp magazines and so forth that these tube shuttles go under the oceans and what have you. My research indicates it's certainly technically feasible. Whether it has been done, I don't know, but my research shows not only is it technically feasible, but there have been different federal agencies talking about this. One of them was the China Lake Naval Station way back in 1966, where there was a study that was published, an R&D study, entitled the Rock Site Program. And China Lake did a whole series of studies and work came out of there related to the idea of making deeply buried underground facilities and tunnels hundreds of miles out to sea, right under the ocean, under major bodies of water. So that was like over 40 years ago. Again, I can't prove that that was done, but I have a lot of suggestive circumstantial evidence that argues strongly that it was. Now, getting back to the Nazi era, there was a during the period of the Third Reich and even continuing after the war for some years, there was a popular German mass media publication that was called the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung. And way back in the period of the Third Reich, before, actually in 1938, before the outbreak of hostilities in World War II, there was an engineer, very gifted, named Hermann Kemper, who took out a Reichs patent, number 643316, and I have those documents, the German patents, and I also have the original articles that were published in the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung. And what he designed, and it's quite dramatic, he called it in German, Die Rohrbahn. And the vacuum train, if you will, or tube train, something like that, which essentially was a magnetic levitation train that would go through huge vacuum tubes, tunnels through from which the air had been totally or partially evacuated, and there was to be a tube train system underground running from Berlin up to what was then Königsberg. I think today it's Kaliningrad, and then over to Breslau. Another would go over to down to Vienna, to Munich, to Munich, or München, over to Basel, to Paris, to Brussels, to Hamburg, to Bremen, Aachen, different places, you see, Leipzig. And that was in 1938. You see, 70 years ago, he had the plans for all of this and the patents. Now you say, well, surely World War II put the kibosh on this or to this. No, his work continued right at the height of the Third Reich. He continued working the whole time. I don't know if the Nazis ever built this system in whole or in part. I don't know what happened to Hermann Kemper after the war. It's hard to trace his career after that. I think he did work as an engineer for a period. I don't know if the Americans ever had him working on a system over here. However, what's interesting to me is the system as he sets it out. I have the schematics for this, some wonderful illustrations and all the patents. As he sets it out 70 years ago, it could have been built with technology existent in the 1930s. Very closely resembles what is being discussed today. Now, the interesting thing is, in the 1970s, 40 years after that, the United States Department of Transportation started a parallel R&D effort to design and ostensibly to build something that virtually mirrors what Hermann Kemper was developing back in the late 30s and early 40s here in the United States. And there was a flurry of technical reports and research and design reports and things like that that came out of the U.S. Department of Transportation. You know, for a tube shuttle system that could have gone as much as 14,000 miles per hour.
My goodness, that is incomprehensible standing on the ground watching something move that fast, you know.
I mean, just, in other words, could go around the planet a couple of hours. And then there were some more modest designs where the speeds would have only been, you know, like 1 or 2,000 miles per hour, which is still really moving. It's faster than a commercial airliner. Mm-hmm. Now, has this been done in secret? In other words, was this R&D taken black starting in the early 80s? I don't know, but wouldn't you know it's during the 1980s where these stories of a secret high-speed underground tube shuttle train system under the United States first started to pop up.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know, Don. I can just say...
That sort of brings us to Phil Schneider's revelations to some extent, and I've never seen, you know, firsthand the collection of photographs that he had, but we have an official in Norway who describes having been taken down into one of these systems and is actually witnessing crystals controlling everything, you know.
Well, let's clarify that. We don't know who this person is. What we have is someone who purports. But we have actually not even a second-hand report, it's a third-hand report of a person who purports to be an official in Norway who alleges to have seen, you know, this, that, and the other. That's what we have. That doesn't, for my purposes, that doesn't pass my muster. That's not the way I research. What this I don't even know if this person exists, number one, or if what they allege to have seen and to know is the case. Anyone can pretend to be someone important and put on airs and say, but I can't tell you because it's all classified and I might be killed if I revealed my identity. I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You could.
Yeah, they could be fear mongers, you know, and
well, so. Or just garden variety liars or disinformation agents.
Yes,
I could easily do that. In fact, with everything I know, I could make up far better stories than that, Don. But
you haven't heard anything that fits that description, then I'm guessing, other than that story.
Well, I've heard a lot of strange stories. More than you can shake a stick at. But what I do in my research is stick to what I can demonstrate, and what I can demonstrate in and of itself is very interesting. I will tell you that one of my sources has worked in many underground installations, and he told me, quite frankly, that there are many secret underground bases, and that thousands of people are working in them. Well, I already knew that, but it's nice to get, you know, have that kind of ratification. With respect to Phil Schneider, he's dead. Dead men tell no tales. I don't know, you know, for better or for worse, how Phil Schneider died. There are all kinds of rumors circulating on the internet. I wasn't there when he died. I've never seen the coroner report or police report. I didn't know him personally, although I did talk with him a couple of times by telephone in the months before he died. So I don't know how much of what Phil Schneider said was true. I don't know if he actually was personally involved in the programs he said he was personally involved in. I don't know that.
Yeah.
No one has any proof of that beyond Phil Schneider's say-so. He did tell me he was going to send me a lot of documentation that would corroborate what he was telling me. I never received one scrap of paper from Phil. And then, you know, as the months went by, he turned up dead, or ostensibly so. And so I don't know. I can't tell you. I can say that certainly there is an element of truth in the things that Phil said. But how much of what he said was true, I can't say. Certainly there are underground bases. Certainly there are secret programs and projects in them. But whether he himself was involved in making them or whether he was actually in a shootout with aliens underground, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he did show his scars.
He said he was, but I don't know.
Those are some pretty unique scars he had, too, and they seem to fit.
And you can get scars in all kinds of ways. I didn't ever see the scars, so I can't personally say what they were like, but, you know, people get scars in all kinds of ways in combat, from burning. Some people mutilate themselves. I'm not saying he did. I don't know how he got the scars that he alleged to have, or what they signify.
Yeah, he had some of his fingers were actually burned off.
I used to work in a foundry, you know, when I was a young man. And one of the things that happens in a foundry is if you're not careful, molten metal will splash on you and you can get horrific burns. Your finger will burn off in half a second. You could lose your arm right up to the elbow or something like that. So there are many ways to get
I understand what you're saying is that we really have to weigh these things out and
I have no idea what happened to Phil or how what happened to him happened. I do know that there is an element of truth in what he said, and that there certainly are secret major underground bases, and there's a lot of money and technology down there. There are certainly thousands of people involved in programs and projects associated with them. And I'm prepared to believe that a lot of what happens down there is very strange.
Yeah.
But whether every particular Phil story was true or not, I can't say.
Yeah. What the general consensus is that he was telling the truth about something, we'll say.
In my case, I'm not even interested in the general consensus or what the mass mind thinks. And I'll be real frank with you.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm interested in is what I can document to the extent that I can objectively do it using fairly rigorous criteria, because the mass mind is capable of entertaining 5 false thoughts and fervently so before breakfast. we see it all of the time. So if I was concerned about the general consensus, I wouldn't have started this research to begin with because it's very fringe kind of research in a sense. But having started it, I found out that there's some very interesting projects and programs going on. They're very secretive, and I'm still plumbing the depths. I haven't come anywhere near to getting through to the bottom of this. I don't anymore know from a physical standpoint how deep and extensive this underground base system is. I don't know when it started. I don't know exactly who all is involved down there. I don't even know, though I've asked more than once, how many people are living and working underground. The picture that is coming into focus for me is, because it's all so compartmentalized, mm-hmm. and there are different levels, both in terms of bureaucracy and administration, and also just physically as you go down and down and down, tens, hundreds, thousands of feet and miles, that it's quite probable that there's no one who knows how many people are involved underground and exactly what is happening there. You
yeah.
may know what's happening in your own programs and in your own compartment or compartments, but beyond that, you're feeling your way along with everyone else. I can tell you that my books are in the library at the Naval Academy at Annapolis. The CIA also has one or two of my books, and another federal facility or two. So, you know, these agencies themselves read the kind of literature that people like Richard Sauter produce, because the compartmentalization is so extreme that they don't know outside mm-hmm. outside of their bailiwick. They don't know what's happening, and so they can learn something from reading my research.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the first part of this interview where you discussed the Nazis, there's
yes.
Quite a bit of information coming forth in more recent years regarding the association between the Thule Society and the Vril Society, which is a bit more secretive, and their association with the certain cave-dwelling monks in Tibet, and that they had an
yes.
interest in what they were able to do with their alchemy or their metaphysical understanding. And do you see a relationship between the Nazis building these underground bases and what they learned from the Tibetans, which is also a connection
yes, yes. When
between
you talk
Egypt
about that,
and Montauk? Yeah.
Yes, when you talk about that type of operation, you have to realize that the Third Reich had different organs and organizations associated with it, some of which were military or paramilitary, like the Wehrmacht, of course, or the Luftwaffe, or the Kriegsmarine, those types of organizations, or paramilitary organizations like the SS or the Gestapo, those types of things.
Yeah, the Abwehr,
then,
the Dachau DVD.
Well,
yes.
well, and but then you also had things such as the Ahnenerbe, for which there is no exact analog in our society, really in the modern era, by which I mean basically the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. I can't think of any other society on Earth outside of the Third Reich that has had a society exactly like the Ahnenerbe. The Ahnenerbe kind of had a broad mandate to look into cultural, genetic, and esoteric matters that were of interest to Hitler and the High Command, and that the SS, among other organizations, placed a priority on. The SA, to a lesser extent, they were more of a security organization. And one of the things that the Nazis did was look into exotic technologies. And there's mm-hmm. some reason to think that the Ahnenerbe sent out teams various places in Europe itself, and also in North Africa and in Asia, Central Asia, and other places. And they were looking not only for the cultural and genetic antecedents of the so-called Aryan peoples, the Indo-European peoples, but they were also looking to find technology and esoteric and occult knowledge and information and data, historical and engineering data, among other things. And evidently they had some success. There's, as you mentioned, there were monks that Anand Erba brought back to Germany, and they were there right in Berlin when it all fell apart in the spring of 1945. Mm-hmm. And there are also indications that they did bring back ancient esoteric information, knowledge, and technology, not only from Asia, but from other places in Europe and other places too. Now, I want to shift a little bit and point out that the Germans, the German engineers and scientists and people affiliated with Anand Erba were certainly aware of ancient Egypt and what went on there. And it's interesting to me that when Project Paperclip was looking for people to bring into the United States after World War II, frequently the mainstream press will focus on, Wernher von Braun, because he headed up the Apollo space program. He and his team, and he brought with him more than 100 scientists and engineers, were brought first to Texas, and they went out to Fort Bliss in West Texas, and then shortly after that, they went out to White Sands in New Mexico, the White Sands Missile Range, where for several years they fired off hundreds of V-2 rockets. The U.S. Army Air Force, at the close of World War II, went in and confiscated all of the intact V-2 rockets and all of the V-2 rockets under assembly and all the engineers and scientists and parts and schematics that they could put their hands on, and brought it all over here and fired off hundreds of test flights of V-2s from White Sands. Interestingly, their missile launch complex there was launch pad number 33. There was only one launch pad, and it was launch pad 33.
Yeah, a little Masonic token there, it sounds like.
Well, yes, and you have to understand that when that von Braun and his team, Kurt Debus and all of these other guys, they went all the way with him from White Sands in those years. Then a bunch of them went over to the Redstone Army Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama. And then from there, where they produced ballistic missiles for the Army during the 1950s. And then NASA wanted them to work on stronger boosters so that they could put up satellites and ultimately manned capsules into orbit and then finally go to the moon with the Saturn series of rockets, most powerful of which was the Saturn V. And von Braun headed all of that up. And Kurt Debus, these are SS guys. Kurt Debus was the guy who actually ran Cape Canaveral at the height of the Apollo moon program. Now, I want to say something in that regard, and it's a complex thread here, but it all hangs together.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, the manned space program essentially was headed up by a guy named Kenneth Kleinknecht, who was the brother of the man who was the in charge of the Scottish Rite 33rd degree Masonic Temple in Washington, D.C., on 16th Street, just north of the White House. And a lot of the early astronauts for NASA were Masons. In fact, Buzz Aldrin, second man on the moon, carried a Masonic flag to the moon and had a Masonic ceremony there while he was walking on the moon with Neil Armstrong. And when he returned to Earth, they held a ceremony for him in the 33rd degree temple there on 16th Street in Washington, D.C., and the flag he took to the moon is in their museum there. I've seen it myself personally. So the 33rd degree Masons in Washington, D.C., Scottish Rite Masons, had a very close connection, a very close, intimate connection with the manned space program in the 1950s and 1960s. Kenneth Kleinknecht came over from NACA when it phased into NASA in the late 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mention this for a reason, and that is at the same time that all of this was going on, and this grew out of Project Paperclip, you see. Most people don't understand that NASA, in a very real sense, grew out of Project Paperclip. Without Project Paperclip, there would be no NASA as we understand it today and as we have known it, starting in the 50s with John Glenn and Neil Armstrong and all of that, because this core of Nazi scientists and engineers, that was their baby. They did this. Now, you have to understand, at the same time, the guy who was heading up all of this came over from Egypt. And it's fascinating because in the 1960s, NASA reached down into the oil patch in Egypt and actually brought over a man who was a newly minted PhD in geology, and had him head up the essentially the manned program on the moon. He remains to this present day at Boston College up in Boston, and he is the head or the forerunner, really, the I guess you'd call him the father of remote sensing in the modern era. Now, I'll give you his name in a minute. Why I find that interesting is because at the same time there was a parallel Project Paperclip, if you will, going on in Egypt. His name is Farouk Elbaz, by the way. But okay. There was a parallel project going on in Egypt at Heliopolis at factory number 333. And the one who was heading up this parallel Project Paperclip in Egypt, if you will, with hundreds of ex-Nazi Germans, scientists and engineers, was Eugen Sanger. Eugen Sanger was essentially the, along with his wife Irene, who in her own right was a gifted scientist and engineer, essentially was the father of the boost glide technology, which we know as the space shuttle today. Eugen Sanger, in a sense, was the godfather of all of these guys, including Wernher von Braun. And you have to understand, at the close of World War II, the person who was in charge all through the war of the Nazi missile-guided missile program was an SS officer, General Walter Dornberger. And he was commanding officer for Wernher von Braun. He also was brought over under Project Paperclip after World War II and went to Bell Helicopter in upstate New York, a helicopter company. And essentially, he was the guy who put together the operating plans for what was to be the so-called Dinosaur program, DYNA-SOAR, which was the Air Force's manned space flight program during the 1950s and early 60s, ostensibly abandoned, but I and at least one other really good researcher that I know of think that it wasn't abandoned, perhaps just given a different name and proceeded in the black realm. But you have to understand that Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon, didn't start out as a NASA astronaut. He was a Dinosaur astronaut and came over to the NASA program from the Dinosaur astronaut program. Mm-hmm. And the Dinosaur program also intended to put up manned capsules. These would have been more like Buck Rogers-style space planes, using the Titan series of rockets, which finally were used to put up the Gemini space capsules, by the way. So the thing is that Dornberger then had a long career for Bell, and he worked really hard on the Dinosaur. He brought over the plans, essentially, for the technology that became the basis of the Dinosaur with him from Nazi Germany. He brought everything over, the schematics, the R&D specifics, all of that. All of the R&D work had been done by him and his team. And so all of this, he brought that over with him in the late 40s, and the space shuttle didn't get going for another 30 years. So you see, the Nazis were 30 to 70 years ahead of the Americans technologically at the end of World War II.
Yes, I'm in agreement with you. Now, Richard, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I would like to have you back. I'd like to explore this further because we seem to have arrived at a point where we could continue for the rest of the day, rest of the night. This is very interesting, very educational, and I wonder if you would come back and share some more of your vast knowledge with us.
I'd be happy to, Don, and we can spin off in a lot of different directions. I have a lot of information, and as you observe, we've just laid the introduction for a lot of things.
Yeah, we just scratched the surface, pun intended.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll try to get you several times in February if you would honor us with your presence. And
I'd be happy to come back.
I want to wish you the best. Happy New Year to you and all of that. And I'm sure I'm going to get a flood of email. And we'll look forward to getting that. And anything pertinent, I'll forward to you, as well as I'll probably be compiling a list of questions and topics that I would like to jump into. So I thank you. I'm sorry to have to end the show so soon, but we'll be seeing you again real soon on Evident Footprints. You take care.
Thank you, Don, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners, too.
Thank you. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Dr. Richard Souder. He will be with us again. You have my word and his that will take place in February. In the meantime, special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And tonight, Don Newsom on the sound. Thanks, Don. And to the listening audience, thank you so much for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow night for another great episode of Evident Footprints. In the meantime, I wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.